Geekscape.com. Ancient Eugenics, Part 3. These early-stage eugenics had their measure of success. The modern school of anthropogeography, following in the footsteps of Mill and Buckle in an older generation, would attribute to material environment their limitations and their greatness. Surrounded by discontented subjects and hostile serfs, with enemies at their very doors, and no point in the land a day's march away, it was natural that they passed their days as in a camp, shut away in hollow Lacedaemon with its many veils. It was natural that they had no share in the progress of the world around them. But in the 7th century, lyric poetry had found a new home on the banks of the Eurotas. Terpander, the Lesbian, Alcman, the Lydian, Cynothon, the Spartan, showed that there was a time when Lacedaemon also had cultivated the muses. The nobles lived luxuriously, and the individual was free. The Lycurgian discipline was therefore no arbitrary product of circumstance. It was a deliberate and calculated policy. As such, it is easy to criticize its limitations, to assert that it mistook the means for the end, that it fitted the citizen only for war and unfitted him for peace. It is a willful neglect of facts to declare that the only success achieved was the success of the disciplined against the undisciplined, that the only veneration the Spartans received was the veneration of conquerors. Their whole aim was narrow, calculated, and egotistic. Their eugenic system was merely ancillary to the one occupation of war. Neglecting all the complexity of man's psychical nature, it aimed at the improvement of a single aspect of humanity, and that not the highest, sacrificing the Sudra caste in the interests of the Brahmins. It aimed only at the production of a breed of supermen. Nevertheless, it is clear that within its narrow confines, this rude system succeeded. Sparta has been proclaimed the only state in which the physical improvement of the race was undoubted, while the chastity and refinement of both sexes was unimpaired. It is easy to see, declared Xenophon, that these measures with regard to childbearing, opposed as they were to the customs of the rest of Greece, produced a race excelling in size and strength. Not easily would one find people healthier or more physically useful than the Spartans. The Lampito of Aristophanes, introduced as the representative of her race, shows how the Spartan women impressed the rest of Greece. Beauty, physique, self-control, these were the accepted characteristics of the type. Sparta was the proverbial land of fair women. The direct influence of Spartan eugenics was infinitesimal. It was an honour to have a Spartan nurse and good form to affect the rude abruptness of the Spartan manner, but no attempt was ever made to adopt their training or institutions. There were the paper polities of Plato and Diogenes, but their legacy to the world was only words and writings. The Athenians of the 5th century had nothing but contempt for the institutions of their rivals, voiced in the patriotic travesties of Euripides. Sparta was the national foe, and Sparta fell into early decadence. Xenophon lamented that in his time the Spartans neither obeyed God nor the laws of Lycurgus. Already, when Plato wrote the laws, there are signs that Sparta was falling into disrepute, and the politics of Aristotle show an imminent degeneracy. Ares bears the yoke of Aphrodite. Liberty has become license. Agis III attempted in vain to restore the old Lycurgian discipline, which had become a mere shadow and a name. Cleomenes attained some measure of success, but foreign arms intervened. Nevertheless, the empty husk of the ancient system lasted with strange persistence through centuries of neglect. If the Spartan eugenics had taken some account of those other tendencies of its earlier history, its influence on the world might have been of greater importance. The ancients, struck by certain obvious resemblances, believed that the Spartan constitution was in part a plagiarism of the Cretan. The laws and institutions of both countries aimed at creating a class of warriors, but in general, most new things are an improvement upon the old, and the Cretans never reached back beyond the education of the youth. The physical training at Crete may have suggested its parallel at Sparta, but its broader basis of culture belonged to Crete alone. Like Sparta, Crete endeavoured, by artificial interference, to regulate the growth of its population, raising its numbers by forbidding celibacy, reducing them by a curious measure which has no parallel elsewhere. In this matter of eugenics, therefore, Sparta owes but little to Crete. The constitution of Carthage was also declared by Aristotle to bear a close resemblance in some particulars to the Spartan. But there is no trace at Carthage of any institution having a eugenic tendency. There is infanticide, but infanticide merely as a phase of a general custom of human sacrifice. There is, however, one other ancient race among whom we find traces of eugenic practice, the sturdy warriors of Germania, Transrhenana, or Barbara. They were not, indeed, an utterly primitive people. Of art and literature, they were almost entirely ignorant. Of the civilization of Greek and Italian cities, they knew nothing. But they possessed a definite social organization and a religion not lacking in nobler elements. Unfortunately, our only authority is a writer concerned more with ethics than history, treating facts with a certain Procrustean freedom to fit a preconceived morality. History becomes the handmaid to moral contrast, and there are the errors of imperfect information, on which no light is thrown by others who have dealt with this same people. It was a system, so far as one could judge, that relied on positive methods. To limit the number of their children, or to put to death any of the later born, they regarded as an act repugnant to human nature. There are no rewards for the childless. Two distinct points are involved in this approbation: uncontrolled reproduction and absence of callous infanticide. At Rome, among the many excuses for exposure or infanticide recognized by custom, was the birth of a child after the will had been made. This does not necessarily prove the total absence of infanticide among the Germans. It merely indicates the prohibition of the practice from callous indolence or on the grounds of superfluity. Tacitus, however, makes the same statement of the Jews, to whom, having before them the injunction to increase and multiply, the whole practice would naturally be abhorrent. Possibly, therefore, the Germans, in contradistinction to almost all ancient peoples, had refused to sanction the custom on any basis whatsoever. In the matter of uncontrolled reproduction, a high birth rate, though negatived almost invariably by a corresponding death rate, was a natural ideal among a people threatened with constant depletion by the severity of military selection. Tacitus, ignorant of relativism, failed to see that the evil he deprecated in Rome was the inevitable result of the tendency which he lauded amongst the Germans. The basis of selection was stature as well as strength. Infanticide, therefore, would have been impossible as a check on failure. Early marriages were forbidden, but instead of a penalty on the childless, we find an encouragement of celibacy. It seems, therefore, that there was some endeavour to limit the number of children, which found no place in the Tacitian scheme of German morality. In place of the Spartan compliance, we find polygamy, on a limited scale, conceded as a privilege only to a few, on account of noble birth. Satisfied with this regulation of nature, they paid no attention to nurture. The children grew to manhood, naked and uncared for, with no distinction between master and slave. The women, it seems, like the women of the Republic, followed their husbands into war. The results of this system appear inevitable enough. We find a race conspicuous for its stature and strength, but conspicuous also for its absence of moral courage. The children, says Tacitus, reproduce the vigour of their parents, and he speaks of their stature and strength of limb as the admiration of the Romans. Their tallness is frequently a theme for comment in the histories. When Rome fell to the Flavianists, it was assumed that anyone of exceptional stature was a Vitalianist and a German. But they were mere machines with no moral courage to turn their strength to account. With Spartan training to develop the raw material of inheritance, they would have been a different race. They were incapable of enduring hardships to which they had not been inured. Their frames were huge, but vigorous only for attack. Their strength was great for sudden effort, but they could not endure wounds. Their courage was the frenzy of the berserk, not the disciplined valour of the Spartan hoplite. In time, their stature must have deteriorated. While the children of tall parents tend to be taller than average, there is a gradual return to the mean. However severe and continuous the selection, there is a point beyond which advance cannot go. The German eugenics seem to have left no impression upon the Roman mind. Their stature and physique were attributed merely to chastity. The German system, therefore, led nowhere in antiquity. The Spartan system led on to the theories of Plato and Aristotle. The 5th century at Athens was an age of criticism and self-consciousness. The era of reflection had followed the era of intuition, and scepticism brought iconoclasm, which shattered the ancient symbols. There were abolitionists, collectivists, social reformers in every phase, but no scheme of eugenics until Plato. Intensity of anti-Spartan sentiment may have put such theories beyond the pale of the patriot. Social reformers could find their arguments for communism or promiscuity among Hyperboreans, Libyans, and Agathyrese, but eugenics was a creed peculiar to the hereditary foe. Nevertheless, certain aspects of the question had been for centuries the commonplace of Greek thought. Even in the proverbial stage of Greek philosophy, the gnomic poets, among their isolated apothegms, have caught some facets of the truth. In Theognis, there is a glimpse of the analogy between the breeding of animals and humankind, and almost an anticipatory scheme of eugenics. We seek well-bred rams and sheep and horses, and one wishes to breed from these. Yet a good man is willing to marry an evil wife, if she bring him wealth. Nor does a woman refuse to marry an evil husband, who is rich, for men reverence money. And the good marry the evil, and the evil the good. Wealth has confounded the race. His starting point is the true one, remarks the ancient commentator, for he begins with good birth. He thought that neither man nor any other living creature could be good unless those who were to give him birth were good. So he used the analogy of other animals, which are not reared carelessly, but tended with individual attention, that they may be noblest. These words of the poet show that men do not know how to bear children, and so the race degenerates, the worse ever mingling with the better. Most people imagine that the poet is merely indicting the custom of marrying the low-born and vicious for the sake of money. To me, it seems that this is an indictment of man's ignorance of his own life. Lycurgus, according to Plutarch, used this analogy to demonstrate the folly of other cities where the husbands, keeping their wives in seclusion, beget children from them even if mad, diseased, or past their prime. This was the starting point of the Spartan eugenics, as it has been the starting point of the modern. At Athens, it was never more than the sententious maxim of an early poet. The evils of disparity of age, the thought that one must consider the ages of those who are brought together, had formed themes for Hesiod, Sappho, and Theognis. Pythagoras, it is said, had discussed the bad effects of early marriage. Solon had legislated upon it, and had dealt no less with that other recognized evil of antiquity and modern times, the mercenary marriage. A problem that obsessed the Greeks was the relative influence of nature and nurture, of gametic and non-gametic causes. It is a question almost invariably of morals, though the dominant aestheticism of Greek thought may have reduced the problem to a single issue. Thou art unpleasing to look upon, and thy character is like to thy form. Most children are worse than their parents, few are better. The evil are not wholly evil from birth, but associating with the evil, they have learnt unseemly deeds. Sometimes a noble offspring does not spring from well-born parents, nor an evil child from useless parents. But the general view of heredity was as fatalistic as Ibsenism. No education can make the bad man good. No Aesculapius can cure the moral taint. Just as roses and hyacinths do not spring from squills, so from a slave woman no free child can be born. Antigone of Sophocles is fierce because her father was fierce, just as the brand of Ibsen was obstinate because his mother was obstinate. Modern knowledge has justified the Greeks in attributing this dominance to heredity. Men do not gather grapes of thorns or figs of thistles. The total contribution of environment is merely opportunity. It can only aid or retard the development of genetic character. The Greeks, except in the dramatic conception of an ancestral curse or in the inherited pollution of ancient sacrilege, never traced causes back beyond the immediate progenitors. Galton held that the individual was the arithmetic mean of three different quantities, his father and mother, and the whole species of maternal and paternal ancestors, going back in a double series to the very beginnings of all life. Greek thought never concerned itself with this third and unknown datum. Mendelism has brought us back once more to the immediate parents. Side by side with this interest in questions of nature and nurture is the dawn of that individualistic spirit, which culminated at last in egotistic contempt of offspring and marriage. Heraclitus is the forerunner of Stoicism, Democritus of Epicureanism, and the negative teaching of the Sophists is the precursor of that atomistic conception of society which reduced it to a mere complex of self-centered units. If there had been any attempt to systematize these fragmentary conceptions, we should find it mirrored in the pages of Euripides. All the inconsistencies of current theory are voiced by opposing characters, every speculation that was born, in that great seething chaos of hope and despair, thesis and antithesis, but no synthesis before Plato. It is the diagnosis, and not the remedy, which interests Euripides. There is the question of the marriage age. It is a baneful thing to give one's children in wedlock to the aged. The aged husband is a bane to the youthful wife. No less is it an evil to wed youth to youth, for the vigour of the husband endures for longer, but a woman more quickly fades from her prime. There is the denunciation, too, of mercenary marriage. Those who marry for position or wealth know not how to marry. Nature endures. Wealth is fleeting. Is it not, therefore, the duty of the man, who takes good counsel, to marry the noble, and to give in marriage among the noble, and to have no desire for an evil wedlock, even if one should thereby win a wealthy dower? There is much discussion of the relative influence of heredity and environment. Is it not wonderful that poor soil, blessed with a favourable season from the gods, bears corn in abundance, whilst good soil, deprived of what it should have received, yields but a poor crop? Yet with humankind, the worthless is always base, and the noble never anything but noble. Is it the parents who make the difference, or the modes of training? And the answer of the ancients was that nature is greatest. How true the old tale that no good child will ever come from an evil parent. The opinion that children resemble their parents is oftentimes proved true. Noble children are born from noble sires. The base are like in nature to their father. If one were to yoke good with bad, no good offspring would be born. But if both parents are good, they will bear noble children. Nevertheless, mortal natures are complex things. A child of no account may be born of a noble sire, and good children from evil parents, but no education can transform the bad child of evil stock. The fairest gift that one can give children is to be born of noble parents. I bid all mortals beget well-born children from noble sires. And the well-born man is a man who is noble in character, not the unjust man, though he be born of a better father than Zeus. Nevertheless, it remains a duty to educate one's children well. Specialized athleticism is as baneful as over-refinement. You cannot fight an enemy with quoits, nor drive them out with the fist. Though war is an evil, military training is an advantage to youth. Euripides reflects no less the growing cynicism of the age, abusing women, praising celibacy, denouncing the cares and anxieties of bringing up children. There is something, too, of the philosophic egotism of Marcus Aurelius. If you marry, your children may turn out evil. If they are good, there is the fear of losing them. But in the Ion, he speaks with the voice of the old Athenian morality. I hate the childless, and blame the man to whom such a life seems good. There is one passage which served as a text for Plutarch's treatise on education and might serve no less today as a text for modern eugenics. Aristophanes also reflects all the foibles and obsessions of a sceptical age. The existence of eugenics at Sparta, robbing the theory of something of the revolutionary aspect which it wears today, would perhaps have rendered it less a feature for debate than community of wives or women's rights. Nevertheless, if eugenics had ever taken a prominent place in Athenian thought, it would have furnished a richer mine of parody than the fantastic obscenity of the Ecclesia Zuzae. It is commonly held that Socrates suggested all the thought and philosophy of the succeeding centuries. We should expect, therefore, to find some cartography, as it were, of eugenics paving the way for the fuller imaginings of his pupil Plato. If we regard Xenophon as the only trustworthy source for the oral teachings of Socrates, we may seek in the memorabilia for these earlier adumbrations. We find the old question of nature and nurture, and with it an attempt to solve the problems of heredity. How is it, asks Hippias, that parents of good stock do not always produce children as good? To put the dilemma in a modern form, why is it that personal value is not necessarily the same as reproductive value? And the answer which Socrates suggests is an answer which has been given to the same question today. Good stock is not everything. Both parents must be equally in their prime. The apparent anomalies which children present in not reproducing the qualities of their parents only serve to reveal the presence of particular conditions, and among those conditions must be included the changes which organism undergoes by reason of advancing age. There are other conditions also. Eugenics begins earlier than birth. The unborn child must be protected by bestowing due care on the future mother. A man, says Socrates, has a twofold duty towards his wife, to cherish her who is raising up children along with him, and towards children yet unborn, to provide them with things which he thinks will contribute to their well-being. The fatal handicap may have already begun in the starving or overworking of the mother.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.